humanity. Each for each and each will bleed and shed blood for what they each believe. On and on and on we go. Well, some will you see, some won't be. Truth for you and truth will lead you to a sense of heart. Well, now.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Asla Bali, who is an American citizen of Turkish descent. She's a professor at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches courses on public international law, international human rights, and the laws of war. At Yale Law School, she was the coordinator of the Middle East Legal Forum. Welcome to Background Briefing, Asla Bali.
Thanks very much.
And there are some second thoughts coming in about the shoot down of the Turkish reconnaissance plane by Syrian air defenses, which of course led to a NATO meeting one notch below a call for NATO intervention or joining in with Turkey. What do you make of some of the second thoughts from some of the NATO, American and allied officials privately asking questions about what was the mission for the Turkish warplane, even suggestions by some that it may have been a provocation or at the very least it was on a spy mission?
Yeah, so the New York Times did report today that American and allied officials thought that the Turkish warplane may have been on a spy mission, and that's consistent with speculation in the Turkish media that has focused on the murkiness of several of the details of what actually happened. The accounts that are given by Turkey and Syria are not only conflicting, but the Turkish account also appears to conflict with some of the evidence that's undisputed. So, for example, Turkey has insisted that the Turkish fighter jet only strayed into Syrian airspace very briefly and that it was shot down 13 nautical miles outside of Syria's land border, which would place it 1 nautical mile beyond Syria's airspace. But the wreckage is quite clearly not only within Syria's territorial waters, but actually quite close to the border. So just logistically, how it's possible that it was shot and then somehow the wreckage ended up so far from the point that the Turks claim the jet was located at the time of the shooting is something that the Turkish media has been raising as a question. Another question is that the Turkish government has said that the jet was on an ordinary routine mission to test Turkey's radar systems, and yet it appears in the media reports in Turkey that this plane was not equipped for such a test. And in fact, it has been acknowledged by the spokesperson of the foreign ministry, Bülent Arınç, that the fighter jet, which was an F-4 Phantom fighter jet, was in fact equipped for surveillance, despite the fact that the Turks are denying that it was on a surveillance mission. So all of this raises a series of questions that I think any careful analyst would have to say suggest that it may very well have been the case that the circumstances around the fighter jet's mission were not those that were alleged by the Turks, and indeed that the fighter jet may very well have been, as the Syrians claim, in Syrian airspace at the time that it was shot down.
Well, there are also reports that the Turkish warplane may have been shot down by Syrian anti-aircraft guns mounted on the shore, and they only have a range of about 1 to 2 miles. So that would indicate it was actually much closer. The initial report said it was a sophisticated Russian ground-to-air missile. What's your understanding, or at least what's the speculation?
Yes. Again, the Turkish media is rife with speculation around this as well. The wreckage is currently within the control of Syria, again, as I've mentioned, because it's in Syria's territorial waters. The location is only being described not only in the Turkish media but also in the Western media in terms of the depth of the plane's wreckage as opposed to its proximity to the border. So we know that it's at a certain depth, but there is no verified claim in the West as to its proximity. But the Syrians have been very clear that it is within 2 nautical miles of their border, the wreckage, and that indeed they claim that it was shot by ground-based machine gun fire that would only have had a range of 2.5 kilometers, which is essentially 1 nautical mile, given the way that the correspondence works between nautical miles, which again are different than miles. The calculation is somewhat confused by the fact that different parties are invoking kilometers, miles, and nautical miles. But in any case, what remains to be verified is the actual location of the wreckage, and once that is verified, the tail, which has been recovered apparently, needs to be examined by a third party. The Turks are insisting it was hit by a missile. the Syrians are claiming that there are holes in the tail that of the jet that verify that it was struck by machine gun fire that could not have had a range that would have reached even the limits of Syria's airspace, but rather would suggest that the jet was very close to Syria's land border. And if that were in fact true, if one could establish that the tail wreckage did reflect such holes, then the Syrian claims would be quite seriously substantiated.
Well, this doesn't in any way let the Syrians off the hook in terms of their being on a hair trigger. And my understanding is from intelligence sources that there was quite a vigorous effort on the part of former French President Sarkozy, along with Saudi Defense Minister Prince Salman, who's now been elevated to the Crown Prince because of the death of Prince Nayef, that they both weighed in on Obama just before the French elections. I guess Sarkozy was trying to pull off some kind of October surprise to stop his defeat there. They apparently had offered a plan for the aircraft carrier Charles de Gaulle to use its warplanes to attack Assad's palace on a mountaintop, and along with the Saudis coming across with their aircraft across the Jordanian border, and they wanted the U.S. to use electronic countermeasures to suppress the Syrian air defenses, which are apparently quite sophisticated, because apparently Obama thought that the whole thing was kind of harebrained. So whether or not that's true, what's your explanation of why the Syrians are on such a hair trigger?
So I think, in fact, that if the Syrians interpreted the Turkish fighter jet's presence as a combination of a surveillance mission and a testing of Syria's defensive capacity, they would wish to illustrate very clearly that they do have a robust air defense capacity, quite distinct from the resources that were available to Libya, precisely to head off the kind of allegedly humanitarian intervention to establish a no-fly zone, which would basically mean an attempt to take out the air defenses of Syria, as had been the case in Libya. In Libya, that proved to be a relatively easy task for NATO because Libya's air defenses were quite limited. But I think Syria might wish to establish that would not be the case should Syria be attacked in a similar fashion in an attempt to establish a no-fly zone. So I think Turkey's goals may very well have been to test Syria's defensive capacities if indeed the flight of that jet was intended to be a kind of test balloon, if you want. And what has resulted is a provocation that Turkey may now use to expand its margin of maneuver, both in that this crisis has already stiffened international resolve against the Assad regime by virtue of the fact that NATO did have a consultation, Turkey did invoke Article 4, and NATO has now said that it's remaining apprised of the situation and will continue to monitor it and so forth. Basically, the Turks have laid a predicate for potential future NATO involvement, and that may have also been a goal. So given that there's no dispute that the Turkish fighter jet flew into Syrian airspace, the likelihood that any one of these scenarios may well have been what motivated that mission suggests that the Syrians' response may also have been calibrated to their concerns about international intentions with respect to their airspace.
Again, I'm speaking with Asla Bali, who is an American citizen of Turkish descent, and she's a professor at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches courses on public international law, international human rights, and the laws of war. Now, Syria and Turkey share a 500-mile-long border, a substantial border, and I take it that there's been an awful lot of activity on that border for some time. There's an enormous number of refugees. Some very senior Syrian military officers apparently only defected last week, including a general and a bunch of colonels. And what you're suggesting here, Asla Bali, is that the Turks now will have a military, not just bolster their military presence on that border, but they may in fact be able to claim some of Syria's airspace in terms of a defensive maneuver? In other words, put up a buffer zone there?
Well, I don't think they will claim Syrian airspace, in fact, because it doesn't appear that it's going to be a buffer zone that's defended from the air. But what the Prime Minister of Turkey, Prime Minister Erdogan, stated yesterday, first is that, and he's this is a translation from the New York Times, he was quoted as saying, at a time, place, and method of its choosing, Turkey will take steps against Syria in retribution for the downing of the jet. So what that tells you, first of all, is that Turkey is banking this as a basis to be invoked in future for engaging in an act of retribution against Syria. That's one. Two, the Turks have said that they are going to redouble their support to the Syrian resistance and Syrian opponents generally, both the Syrian National Council, the civilian political face of the Syrian opposition, and the Free Syrian Army, which represents at least one portion of the military opposition to the Assad regime, are headquartered in Turkey. And the Turkish border, as you've said, has been extremely active, not only because of the transit of refugees and defectors, but also because Saudi and Qatari-financed arms are reportedly flowing freely across the 550-mile border. And indeed, also the New York Times has reported that CIA operatives are based on that border, potentially to offer logistical or other assistance on a covert basis to the Syrian militarized opposition. So that those are the circumstances at the border prior to this incident. Since this incident, the Turks have also announced that they are going to change their rules of engagement and that they're specifically going to define movement within Syrian territory of Syria's military as a hostile threat to which Turkey is entitled to respond. What that means is that Turkey is imposing unilaterally the equivalent of what would be described as a no-drive zone for Syrian forces along the Turkish border. So in other words, they are saying that any ground movement of Syrian forces on their territory but near the Turkish border will be interpreted as a threat. What that means is that the Turks are essentially establishing a corridor 550 miles long along their border with Syria, where Syrian forces will not be able to operate, or if they do, they will be doing so at the risk of an engagement with the Turkish military. This is the equivalent of something that Turkey has been arguing for some time, namely the establishment of either, quote-unquote, a safe zone or, quote-unquote, a humanitarian corridor along the border. The Syrian objection to that is that this border has been used precisely for the stationing of militarized opposition that mount their military attacks from this area. And so they would regard such a safe zone as not an area to protect civilians or to protect Turkish national security, but rather to afford a much wider margin of maneuver to their armed opposition, which Kofi Annan has today described as an insurrection.
And the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad, for the first time went on television and described the situation in Syria as a civil war following an attack on the government television and also Republican Guards barracks right inside of the capital, Damascus. But Asla Bali, I've also heard reports that in the past, since this uprising has been underway, that Syrian helicopters have crossed into Turkish airspace and in some cases in pursuit of those fleeing Syria.
Yes, that's right. The Turkish government reported for the first time that there were five instances of Syrian helicopters crossing into Turkish airspace. Now here, the airspace in question is along that land border, so it's not a matter of territorial waters and so forth, and that's a much, much narrower band of airspace. And also we're talking about helicopters which, by virtue of the technology, fly at a low altitude and are easily detected as opposed to a fighter. They're not describing fighter jets. So this would be action on the part of the Syrians in quote-unquote hot pursuit of what they deem to be individuals that have engaged in attacks and are now attempting to cross into Turkey to flee the counterassault from Syrian forces. I think what the Turks have very clearly indicated now is that any such future crossing of even a tiny portion across the border into Turkish airspace would be deemed a hostile act and would be shot down. But beyond that, that's not remarkable in the sense that any state has the right in self-defense once it deems itself to be hostile to a neighbor to protect against the neighbor engaging in an incursion on its sovereign airspace or territory. But what's remarkable beyond that is that the Turkish prime minister has also invoked a right to treat targets within Syria as a threat and to actually neutralize them while in Syrian territory, which may also include Syrian airspace. So that, I think, is a is a move that would not ordinarily have been supported by international law, but by grounding it in the claim that Syria has engaged in a quote-unquote unprovoked act of aggression, which I think is the facts do not support that claim on the part of the Turkish government, but that is nonetheless what the prime minister has claimed and what NATO has offered support for, despite the private misgivings of apparently American and allied officials. In light of that, Turkey is using that as a basis to assert a set of rights that it would not otherwise have under international law to generate a zone for their operation within Syrian territory and airspace.
Well, Aslam Ali, you mentioned a little while ago that the CIA is involved in that border area, coordinating arms and logistics with the Free Syrian Army. And one would think that given the qualms that most analysts have about a post-Assad Syria and the possibility of a prolonged civil war, enormous amount of bloodletting. Syria apparently has one of the world's largest arsenals of chemical weapons. The idea you have a Somalia on the Mediterranean. There are all these kind of fairly dire scenarios out there. And I've always been puzzled why the U.S. and Turkey have allowed the Saudis to take the lead in arming the Free Syrian Army, because the Saudis have a real political agenda. We've seen what they've done in Egypt, where they essentially financed the Salafists who came out of nowhere and came in second in the parliamentary elections. They clearly have a political agenda, and the idea of Salafists and extremists taking over in Syria is not in the interests of anybody, except the Saudis, I guess.
So there are obviously, in terms of the actual actors on the ground in Syria, their goals are entirely related to a struggle for power within Syria. The Assad regime is seeking to maintain its control, and its opponents are seeking to topple the regime and establish an alternative regime of whatever nature. But in terms of the regional actors, I think the stakes are extremely different and have very little to do with political outcomes on the ground in Syria, and a great deal to do with regional strategic interests, spheres of influence, and so forth. So what is in fact happening, in my view, is that Syria has turned into a proxy war for regional influence, control, markets, access to ports, and so forth, between, on the one side, Sunni Arab states that are pro-U.S., together with Turkey, and on the other side, those states and actors that are aligned with Iran in the region and Russia. So those are that's the division, and within that prism, the fact that the United States and Saudi are aligned on the same side means that considerations about what happens in a day-after scenario within Syria are being subordinated to the goal of essentially viewing this in the kind of grand chessboard scheme as a way of eliminating a pro-Iranian regime and replacing it with a regime aligned with pro-American or pro-Sunni forces in the region. And Turkey appears to be acting in a relatively sectarian way as well. I think that the Turks probably do think that it's important that the opposition, both military and civilian, are based in and headquartered in Turkey, and that Turkey is playing an active role in coordinating aid, arms, and so forth, financing that's coming from Saudi Arabia, because they think ultimately, if Syria does end up becoming a sort of pro-Western Sunni regime, they would prefer to see it be of the nature that the Turks themselves envision for Syria than Salafi, than the kind of regime that Saudi Arabia might prefer. And as a result, there is a subsidiary competition here between different Sunni actors to assert their presence as an important regional actor. But really what's happening, I think, at the broadest level is a competition that is about the strategic interests of regional backers, Russia, Iran, the United States, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and so on, as opposed to the goals and tactics that are being adopted within the country by Syrian actors. So there's that divide, and that divide is producing something that I think represents a very serious moral hazard, which is both sides, whether it's Russia supplying Syria with helicopters and so forth, or Saudi, Qatar, Turkey, U.S. coordinating assistance in the form of arms and financial assistance and so forth, logistical, technical support to the Syrian opposition, are essentially encouraging movement further and further down the road of escalation in the military conflict that, as you say, President Bashar al-Assad has described now as a state of war in Syria. I think others, Observers have said this is a full-blown civil war at this stage, and we've seen at least 12,000 civilian deaths, and that may be an understatement. And if we continue down this road, the amount of time it's going to take for the Syrian militarized opposition to build the resources, operational capacity, logistical knowledge, and just expertise to mount effective operations that could match the capabilities of the Syrian military will be some time. And while that incremental process is going on, you can expect to see tens of thousands more Syrians, civilians caught in the crossfire between these parties. And that is, to my mind, a worst-case scenario. But it is also potentially the most likely scenario at this stage, because what that amounts to is the lowest cost form of intervention for regional actors. So rather than incur losses themselves for their own materiel or their own personnel, to funnel arms into your preferred actor on the ground and continue strengthening them in the hope that you will end up with something other than a Pyrrhic victory, that is going to be a mechanism, whether it's being pursued by Russia and Iran or by the United States and its Sunni Arab allies in Turkey. That will be a scenario through which you will maximize civilian deaths and minimize the likelihood of a secure and stable political outcome in Syria.
Well, just in closing, Asla Bali, it would seem that Libya is a glaring example of the day-after scenario, where various factions were armed and they're still duking it out. And presumably, as much as I understand what you're saying, that they're only concentrating on getting rid of Assad and not thinking about the day after and what's going to happen to all these arms that are pouring in. I had a Syrian filmmaker on yesterday. He just testified before the International Criminal Court. His friends were trying to document atrocities, and they were murdered by the regime. He pointed out that the casualties are at least 15,000, and that, in fact, 100,000 people have been taken into prison. And given the nature of that brutal regime, those people may have already been disappeared, and there are 50,000 people missing. So already, I think the real casualties, if you take that into account, are far greater than what's being discussed already.
Agreed. I mean, there's no question that the Syrian regime is committing war crimes, that I think the 12,000 figure is a vast understatement. I think it's very difficult at this time to have a sense of what the level of casualties are. I think that in addition to the regime's own tactic of engaging in summary executions, of mass detentions and so forth, on top of that, we're also seeing other armed groups engaging in similar tactics, which is only going to further increase and inflate those numbers. So there's no question that this kind of bloodshed, to the extent that anybody cares about consequences on the ground for Syrian civilians, has to come to an end, and indeed that there's no sustainable future for the Assad regime. I think those are givens. The question is, how do you get there? And to my mind, the only way to get there in a way that minimizes civilian casualties is by engaging in a political process, one in which Russia and Iran are brought to the table precisely so that they put the requisite pressure on Syria. Syria is not responsive to pressure from the United States or Turkey because it's not beholden to the United States or Turkey in its pursuit of its current strategy. The regime is, however, beholden to Iran and Russia, and were those countries to be persuaded that they can be part of a day-after scenario, then you might have, instead of Libya, something like the Yemeni transition, in which you have the regime replaced, stepping down, a transition undertaken politically, but not through increased militarization on the ground of opposition forces, but rather through a negotiation including the backers of the regime. Crucially, in Yemen, the Saleh regime agreed to a transition because its principal backer, Saudi Arabia, pressured it to do so. And Saudi Arabia did that because it was assured that it would continue to have a direct influence on the nature of a subsequent regime, that its own sphere of influence would not be compromised, and so forth. And that minimized bloodshed in Yemen. It was not an ideal outcome. I think Egypt is a much more promising outcome in that you have a cleaner break, although, as you've mentioned, there are significant problems in the Egyptian trajectory as well. But it's certainly preferable, the Yemeni trajectory is certainly preferable to the 12,000, 15,000, 150,000, whatever the number may ultimately end up being, civilian deaths and counting that we can now see mounting in Syria.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Asla Bali.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Asla Bali, who is an American citizen of Turkish descent. She's a professor at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches courses on public international law, international human rights, and the laws of war. At Yale Law School, she was the coordinator of the Middle East Legal Forum. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Time.